All right, we are nearing the end of the book here. If all goes well, we're going to finish next Sunday. So that next handout that you have is the last one we're going to go through, but we're not going to get through all of it today. I messed up on the slaves and masters thing and spent too much time on it, so now we're catching everything in between. Instead of finishing a lesson, we're starting one and finishing one every Sunday instead of having it being nice and neat and clean. So sorry about that. But last week we started on this section. It's really the last teaching section in Colossians. As we'll see here, we get into the conclusion part of Colossians. There's a lot of names that we can't pronounce. And what do we do with that? But we're gonna see that here in a minute. But this is the last teaching part of Colossians. And in this section, we're seeing that we need to live for Christ as a witness to unbelievers. And just to give you a little broader perspective of where we've been, we showed this slide last week. But Colossians 3:5 through 4:6 is kind of the meat of the body of the letter. All right, it's the real meat and potatoes of what Paul is getting at. A lot of exhortation there, a lot of application that we can take. And in the first part of that, we had that put on, put off section, 3:5 through 3:17. The key verse in that section was verse 9 of chapter 3. It says, "Do not lie to one another, seeing that you have put off the old self with its practices, and have put on the new self, which is being renewed in the knowledge after the image of its creator." So we put off what we have died to because we're in Christ. We put off the old man Adam. We put on the new man Christ. And because of that, we're able to live a different life. So number two there, as we live for Christ in all of our God-given roles that He's blessed us with. So as fathers, as husbands, as masters, as wives, as children, as slaves, we have a different way that we relate to each other. And so the put-off, put-on section is kind of the bullseye of that dark green circle there. And that affects the way we live. So that there has rippling effects. So that next larger section, our family relationships, it affects the way we relate to one another within our family. And then today we're going to finish up the way we relate to one another as believers and non-believers, okay? And we just broke that down into two parts, verses 2 through 6. We need to pray for unbelievers, and we need to have a plan to reach unbelievers, all right? So last week we talked about praying. How do we do that? Well, we need to pray with perseverance, and that means that we're continually coming to the Lord in prayer. We do that. Another word to use would be devote yourself to prayer, make it a practice, and we can do that by praying with alertness, which means we stay awake when we pray. We also are alert to the times that we're living in, that Christ is coming back, and time is limited, so we are praying with that viewpoint in mind. And because we're praying with that viewpoint, we are also to pray with thanksgiving. And we're giving thanks not only of things that the Lord has done for us in the past, but specifically really for what He's going to do in the future. Claiming the promises that we read in Scripture, understanding that He is faithful and He's always going to keep His promises, so we can thank Him for things that are yet to come, the way He's going to deal with believers, unbelievers, when He comes back, set everything straight. We are thankful for that. So we can pray with being alert. We can pray with thanksgiving. And then obviously we need to pray for the gospel to spread. Paul said that in verse 2, continue steadfastly in prayer, being watchful in it with thanksgiving. At the same time, pray also for us, that God may open to us a door for the word to declare the mystery of Christ, on account of which I'm in prison, that I might make it clear, which is how I ought to speak. So we're to pray for others to have an open door, and pray for ourselves that we would have an open door to share the gospel. And it's a lot easier to pray for others to have that opportunity than for ourselves. But prayer is a way that we can be mindful of that. It's not like we don't have opportunities. We're just blind to them because we're not alert and we're not watchful and we're not thinking about it. So praying for those opportunities, as Russell said last week, sets our mind on that. We're able to see those easier. God's not withholding them from us, we're just missing them, all right? So that was last week. So we're going to be starting on letter B on that handout, to live for Christ as a witness to unbelievers. So letter B is this plan to reach unbelievers. How are we going to do that? As we pray for it, we need to also have a plan. Okay? Colossians 4, 5, and 6 says, walk in wisdom towards outsiders, making the best use of the time. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. So, to have a plan to reach unbelievers, we need to, number one, walk in wisdom. That's your blank there for number one. Walk in wisdom. So, see that this is the command here. Walk in wisdom towards outsiders. And this is not the first time this phrase has popped up in Colossians, that we're to walk in wisdom or walk a certain way. To walk means the way we conduct our life. It's not literally walking somewhere, but it's a metaphor, right? The way we live our life should be in wisdom towards outsiders. So to walk then would be, how do you choose? How you choose to live your life, okay? How are you going to do that? And this is a command. Paul is commanding that the Colossians live out their life with wisdom. And sometimes we see these imperatives in Scripture, and we know it's a command, but then we fail to make the connection. If I don't obey that command, then I am sinning, right? So if you choose not to walk in wisdom toward outsiders, then you are choosing to sin, all right? That's putting it a different way. I put a little different spin on it, think, oh, this is important. I need to pay attention to this. How do I walk in wisdom so I'm not walking in sin toward the way I relate to outsiders? Because it's an imperative. It's a command. So if you remember back in chapter 1, long time ago, verses 9 through 10, Paul prayed that the Colossians would be filled with the knowledge of his will in all spiritual wisdom and understanding, so that they would walk in a manner worthy of the Lord. All right. So now they're to use that wisdom that Paul prayed for. You would be filled with all wisdom. That's a lot of wisdom. Okay. Use that as you relate towards outsiders. Walk in wisdom. So how do you walk in wisdom? All right. Try to break this down in a couple different points. So letter A there is, you need to be deliberate with your time. To be deliberate with your time. It says to walk in wisdom towards outsiders, making the best use of your time. So what does Paul mean by this, making the best use of your time? This can be have a little different nuances depending on where you go to chase this word down. And it was kind of a fun little exercise for me to do a little word study on this. Paul's not saying that we need to buy a day timer and then budget your time well, okay, which we need to do, but this verse is not one that teaches that. What he's, I think, saying here, and we see this in other passages, this verb literally means to buy out of or to redeem, all right, to buy out of or to redeem. Yeah, it's a couple familiar verses in Galatians that this verb is translated redeemed. Galatians 3:13 says, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. And then Galatians 4:4 and 5 is similar. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that they might receive adoptions as sons. So to redeem in that sense, God is buying you back or purchasing you back from the slave market of sin. So God created humanity, obviously sinless, but we chose the sin, Adam chose the sin, and because of that, we each choose sin, and we are enslaved to sin. So Christ's death on the cross redeemed us, bought us back out of that, purchased us out of slavery. So that makes sense in that context, but then when you start talking about time, how do you apply this to time? How do you redeem time? How do you buy back time? It's difficult kind of to see how you would redeem or to purchase time, because once time is passed, you don't get another chance, right? There's no time machine to travel back and buy that time back and have a do-over. So perhaps what Paul's meaning here is, because you can't do that, that's the point, be careful how you spend your time, right? Could be. But there's another, I think there's another passage we can go to that kind of gives us another idea. It does mean to buy back or purchase, right? But in what sense? So the Old Testament was translated into Greek, and so sometimes you can see how at that time they understood a word when they were translating the Hebrew into Greek, and you can compare what happened in the Old Testament. How did they understand this word that's in the New Testament? Give me an example from the Old Testament that I can get some context. And so there is a passage in Daniel that we can go to get another kind of a little idea of what this word means. So it's in Daniel chapter 2. King Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and it troubled him so much he couldn't sleep at night. And this is the dream that he had of a statue that had a head of gold, and then it went all the way down to, I think, feet of iron and clay mixed together, right? And he had this, the dream of it. He couldn't sleep. He was bothered by what this could mean, because he knew it wasn't just a random dream. This was something that he should know about. This was significant. And so he calls his wise men in, and he wants them to give him an interpretation. But he's afraid these wise men are just going to make something up. So he says, not only do I want the interpretation from you, I want you to tell me what I dreamed, and then tell me what it means, right? And they're like, well, how are we going to do that, right? There's no way. And so they start to get pretty panicky, right? So in chapter 2, verses 7 and 8, the wise man answer, it says this, they, the wise man, answered a second time and said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show you its interpretation. And the king answered and said, I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time. There's our word. You are trying to gain time because you see that the word from me is firm. All right, so these wise men are stalling for time. All right, that is the word. This gives us another clue as to what Paul means by making the best use of your time. I think he's saying, use time to your advantage, all right? These wise men knew they couldn't interpret the dream. All they had to their advantage was some extra time. So they're trying to leverage the time they had against the king's edict that they were all going to die if they couldn't interpret this dream, all right? So I think Paul wants us to view time as a tool, not just something that slips through your fingers, right? Time just gets away from us sometimes. Leverage time in your favor when it comes to interacting with outsiders. That gives you a bigger picture, I think, of what Paul means here by making the best use of your time. And another clue here is that the sense for time is not just seconds, minutes, hours. This word for time here can be translated like a season of time, okay? So use the seasons of time that God has given you for your advantage. Leverage that to your advantage when it comes to how you walk in wisdom towards outsiders, okay? How do you do that? What's some examples? Well, whatever season of life you're in, we need to be thinking, how am I going to use this to the advantage of reaching an outsider? Are you a young adult? Maybe you're still single. How do you leverage this season of life to walk in wisdom towards outsiders? This is the time that God's given you. How do you make the best use of that time? Maybe you're married. You don't have any kids yet. How do you leverage this time for gospel outreach? What are you going to do? You keep on going down the line. Maybe you're married with young kids. All right, your days get a little more filled up. All right, you seem to have less time. But then this is the season of life God's given you too. How do you leverage that time to walk in wisdom? Maybe you're married with older kids. There's another season of time that God has given you. What are you going to do with that? Maybe you're retired. Maybe you're going through a health crisis, okay? We often don't think about that, but that's a season of time that God has given you that you can leverage that time to walk in wisdom towards outsiders. It's an opportunity. Maybe you're going through a financial crisis, any crisis. It's not pleasant, but when we get into crisis mode, we kind of get to looking at ourselves and we forget that God's given us an opportunity to be a witness to other people. So use it. Leverage that. Leverage that time that God's given you. Walk in wisdom towards outsiders, making the best use of your time. So hope that means something to you. Hope you get the idea that the command to walk in wisdom towards outsiders is just leveraging that season of time that God has placed you in to your advantage. One way to make the best use of your time is to take care of how you speak, all right? To take care of how you speak. And let's let her be. How do we do that? How do we walk in wisdom? Well, we're going to make the best use of our time, and also we're going to speak with grace. All right? Speak with grace. It says, let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt. So to speak with grace here can mean to speak with kindness, or it can mean to speak of God's grace, right? The grace of God. And it's probably a little of both, right? We wouldn't be wrong to take either view here. The way a person speaks reveals what is in their heart, because the heart of the believer has been transformed. The words they speak should be noticeably different, right? What comes out of your mouth as a believer should be noticeably different than an unbeliever. The way you speak should be kind and gracious, not harsh and rude. But in light of this thinking about making the best opportunity and leveraging your time to walk in wisdom towards outsiders, obviously we need to talk about God's grace. It's not just speaking nice words, it's actually telling about the grace of God. That's what Paul prayed, that he would have an opportunity to share the mystery of Christ. All right, so we need to speak of God's grace, and we need to figure out how do we sprinkle the grace of God into our conversations, okay? And we see this idea when Paul adds seasoned with salt, all right? Just as salt makes food taste better, you got to find ways to make God's grace attractive. Salt, if you've ever eaten even brownies without salt, doesn't taste very good. It's amazing how, or bread without salt. You wouldn't think that, you notice when you're missing the sugar, right? But sometimes when you miss the salt, it just, something's off. What is that, all right? Salt makes things taste good. It also whets the appetite for, you need something to drink after you eat something salty, right? Whets your appetite for the gospel. So how do you make God's grace attractive? This doesn't mean that we leave out certain parts that are hard to understand or water down the gospel, obviously. But it does mean that we need to avoid unnecessary obstacles to the gospel. So what would that be? Well, thinking specifically about speech, let's say that here in a couple months, most of us get to go to soccer games on Saturday mornings, right? And it's an exciting game. It's very competitive. And you notice that your kid that you came to watch, it seems to be getting fouled more than the others. All right, the referee, not Alex, but the referee there, seems to be missing some calls, right? And it's a tight game, and you are competitive, you want to win. So you get a little worked up, and you say some things that you normally probably wouldn't say. It's not, they're not bad things, but you get a little worked up, all right? And you let the ref know that he's not seeing things straight, okay? So that's why we're using our words, and you're thinking of making the best use of the time. It's going to be hard. It's not impossible, but it would be hard to have a gospel conversation with a parent from the other team, or maybe a parent on your team, after you kind of made a little bit of a fool of yourself, right, in that situation. Okay, so that's one way you can season your words with salt. Okay, you don't put unnecessary obstacles in front of the gospel, in the way of the gospel. So leverage your time well, speak kindly, speak of God's grace, and season it with salt. Make it taste good, okay? Be a good example. The next way we can do this is letter C here, to speak with relevance. There's your blank. Letter C, speak with relevance. What does that mean? Well, Paul says, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. The reason your speech should always be gracious, seasoned with salt, is so that you know how to answer different people. Everybody's different, okay? The gospel message doesn't change, but every conversation with each individual outsider, right, is going to be a little different. This is why we need to walk in wisdom and know how to answer each unique conversation. 1 Peter 3:15 puts it this way, and this is in the context of going through trials, right, that season of life that God may put you in. He says, but in your heart, honor Christ as the Lord, honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for the reason of the hope that is within you. And then he says, yet do it with gentleness and respect. Peter's way of saying season it with salt. Okay, do it with gentleness and respect. So, just some concluding thoughts in this section here. In verses 2 through 6, Paul is telling us how we need to live for Christ as a witness to unbelievers. All right, we're going to give us two commands that we need to think about, that we need to pray continually, all right, and we need to walk with wisdom. So we need to pray for outsiders, pray with perseverance by being alert and thankful, asking for opportunities for unbelievers to hear the gospel. And then second, plan to reach outsiders. We need to do this by walking in wisdom. The wisdom includes being deliberate with your time, speaking with grace, and speaking with relevance, answering each person the questions that they might have. So some application questions there at the end of that page, I think you have. Get your feedback here. Just a little scenario. Tom is self-employed, married with 5 kids. They range from 14 down to 3 years old. Between managing his business and caring for his family and his ministry at church, Tom is very busy. What are some ways Tom can leverage this time that God has given him to walk in wisdom towards outsiders? How would you counsel Tom, seeing that he is involved in a lot of things? How can he leverage this time that God has given him as he walks in wisdom towards outsiders?
He's self-employed, so he may have unbelieving employees.
Okay.
So there's an opportunity. And how he treats them and conversations that he would have the opportunity to make.
That's a good observation. So employees, that goes back to our slaves and masters talk here. Yeah, good. Anything else?
The way he runs his business.
The way? So what would be a way that would be, what are you thinking there?
I mean, he's not doing anything underhanded or questioning. He's not lying.
Okay. No. He is a bid, and it's the same as the, or close to what the final price is. Mm-hmm. Hide anything.
He gives his employees time with their families. He wants his time. He can't rob it from his employees.
Yeah. Any other thoughts about
oftentimes we forget that the primary form of evangelism we have is through our children. And so it's counterintuitive, but it's not sacrificing one for the other. His discipling of his family is his primary form of evangelism. And then secondarily, you have activities that they're in and things like that you can reach out to other folks. But yeah, when we look at our kids, like that's our primary audience for evangelism.
So make the best use of your time while your kids are at home. Mm-hmm. I was always told when my kids were younger, it was like, well, just enjoy it while it lasts because it's going to go fast. And I thought, man, getting out of diapers can't go fast enough. There's no way this is going to go very fast. And then, but it does. They were right. I was less right. So make the best use of your time. Yeah. Any other thoughts about just some strategies, the way that Tom can be thinking strategically about his walk towards outsiders? And if this sounds a little bit like my life, it kind of is, because I thought, man, I could get some help here.
I think managing a family well, though, in this society is something that is a testimony to the watching world. So, you take your kids out for a special treat after VBS or after Adventure Club gets over, and you go eat dinner together outside, and you notice families around you, folks will comment, wow, your kids are so well, like they're very well behaved, or things like that. It's like, what an opportunity.
Yeah.
Would you like me to share the foundations of these things, so I think that, like, it's not, like I said, it's not an either or, it's a false dichotomy. It's no, like, by doing these things, by caring for your family, by managing your business well, you are, in a certain way, creating an opportunity for evangelism, because a watching world that takes advantage of people and preys on people for the benefit of self sees the goodness of God in you. So,
what about other tips that you might have? You're not Tom. You don't have that situation, but maybe each of us have a unique, different situation. Maybe you can share some ways that you have walked in wisdom towards outsiders. You can not brag about yourself, but kind of give us some good examples about the ways you fought through this. Some tips for the rest of us that need it.
I would just say, don't overlook the clear declaration of the gospel in the interactions that you are in. I think that speaks to the immediate context of this passage here, as Paul comes from saying, pray for me that God would open a door for the word, that I may declare the mystery of Christ, while on account of which I am in prison. So he was in prison for declaring, but he's also praying that I may still declare, make the best use of my time while I'm in prison, and that I may make it clear, which is how I ought to speak. And he talks about our speech. Mm-hmm. So clear declaration of the gospel should not be overlooked in any relationship or context.
I think that's a good thing to remember. Because I think a lot of times I have the temptation to, I'm good with being a good example in front of people, right? I like that idea. But when that good example gives me an opportunity to have that clear conversation with somebody, I often don't take it, right? So it's not just that you're a good example in front of you, you actually have to say something. This is the hard part, right? The gospel can't be caught just by viewing somebody. It's through the word. The word has to be spoken. The gospel has to be declared and given for somebody to accept that opportunity. So it's a good point.
And David, I think you already said, we've talked about praying for opportunities. I think in that, along with just kind of studying every now and then the doctrine of hell. Hmm. Like, that can help me think, wow, like, if I don't share the gospel, what hope do they have? Like, not that I'm the only one who can share the gospel,
right.
But
yeah.
Like, I might be in, they might be in my life for expressly that purpose. Mm-hmm. And if I don't look for the opportunity, if I don't take the opportunity, then I'm not being obedient to the Lord. And so I'm sinning in that way, and I'm just not loving people. So I think those, I don't pray often enough for opportunities. Mm-hmm. And then, because when you pray for them, you will just start to look for them. Mm-hmm. So I think praying is got to be a big step.
And the people you're surrounded by, work, school, these are people you're around a lot. So thinking of specific people, praying for specific people, and looking for, I know this person is struggling with this, looking for opportunities to share the gospel, to speak into their lives, instead of just, oh, wait till they come say something mm-hmm. to me. That's something I've had to work on. It's like, okay, I need to be more deliberate. Mm-hmm.
That's a good point, because not just saying, Lord, give me somebody, but to have somebody in mind. I'm praying for this person by name. I know they need the gospel. Mm-hmm. I'm around them a lot. Help me to have that opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good. Any other thoughts? All right, that is the last section in the main body of this letter. We're going to go ahead and start on that next handout. Paul's ministry team is the heading on that one. So this is the conclusion of the letter, this last verses 7 through 18 are all of Paul's concluding remarks. So let's go ahead and read that, and we'll try to make some observations here. It says, Tychicus will tell you all about my activities. He is a beloved brother and faithful minister and fellow servant in the Lord. I'm sorry, let me get that up there. I have sent him to you for this very purpose, that you may know how we are, and that he may encourage your hearts. And with him, Onesimus, our faithful and beloved brother, who is one of you. They will tell you everything that has taken place here. And Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, greets you. Mark, the cousin of Barnabas, concerning whom you have received instructions, if he comes to you, welcome him. And Jesus, who is called Justice. These are the only men of the circumcision among my fellow workers for the kingdom of God, and they have been a comfort to me. Epaphras, who is one of you, a servant of Christ Jesus, greets you always, struggling on your behalf in his prayers, that you may stand mature, fully assured in all the will of God. For I bear him witness that he has worked hard for you, for those in Laodicea and Hierapolis. Luke, the beloved physician, greets you, as does Demas. And then the last couple verses, give my greetings to the brothers in Laodicea and Nympha, to the church in her house. And when this letter has been read among you, also have it read in the church of Laodicea. And see that you also read the letter from Laodicea. And say to Acrippus, see that you fulfill the ministry that you have received in the Lord. I, Paul, write this greeting with my own hand. Remember my chains. Grace be with you. So what do you do with that? That last passage. I think when we read through our Bible, or I have to get to the end, I'm like, we're just going to speed through this. And one of the things when I was starting to outline this, I thought, wow, that's going to be a little challenge at the end. What are we going to do there? And I said, well, I'll think about that later. But later's here, so what do we do with it? So listening to sermons and reading some commentaries, this is where I landed. Here's what I think we can take away from these verses, specifically from looking at these eight men that Paul mentions here at the end. This is part of Paul's ministry team. He's given us a little bit of behind-the-scenes glimpse into his team. And I think oftentimes we just assume that Paul was just this super missionary. He just went out by himself. He wrote all these letters. He traveled. And we forget that he wasn't just a one-man band. We know Barnabas, and we know Saul. We know Timothy and Titus. We know they were kind of involved, but other than that, it seems like Paul was, he was Paul, right? But he had so many people working alongside him kind of faithfully behind the scenes, all of these guys that we just read about. And although to us, these names, like I've never heard of these names. Who are these people, right? A few of them maybe are a little familiar, but most to us, they don't mean anything, but apparently they meant something to the people in Colossae, all right, or he wouldn't have mentioned them. Somehow this church knew of these guys. They knew that Paul traveled with these guys. These guys traveled with Paul, and they were familiar with them, and he is just, you know, hey, this guy says hi, all right? And it's nice to get a letter, and you receive a greeting from somebody you haven't seen or heard of for a long time, all right? So the Colossians obviously knew who they were. Paul doesn't expound a lot on them, all right? So it's hard for us to kind of get some information. Who are these guys? But as we observe Paul's missionary team, we're going to see seven spiritual qualities that you need to have for an effective ministry, all right? And then we have one warning of something that we need to avoid. So seven positives, one negative here in these guys. So as we look at Paul's ministry team, we're going to see spiritual qualities for effective ministry, all right? Letter A there. And we're going to start with the first one on the list here is Tychicus. There are eight guys listed in this verse. The first two, we kind of pair these up. The first two are sent out by Paul, and the last six are with Paul. And of those six, three are Jews and three are Gentiles. All right? So Tychicus, I probably go back and say it both ways because I get confused. But I think it's Tychicus, the way you would pronounce it. We're going to learn from him that he was faithful. He was faithful. After studying a little bit more about him, this would be a great name to name one of your kids if it wasn't such a Greek name, right? Like Tychicus, but maybe Ty. Short for Ty. Just a thought. Give me his name. All right? He was faithful. All right? Faithful. To be an effective counselor or working in discipleship, being a part of the ministry team, any team here at church, you also need to be faithful, all right? Letter A there, faithful team members are proven over time. Faithful team members are proven over time. Tychicus is mentioned five times in the New Testament. Every time he's mentioned, it's pretty brief, and we don't know a whole lot about him. But because it is five times, we can kind of piece together a little biography of the kind of man he was. He's first mentioned in Acts chapter 20, verse 4. In this chapter, Paul is finishing up his third missionary journey. He's heading back to Jerusalem. But it seems that Tychicus probably met Paul a few years earlier than it was mentioned in the book of Acts while he spent 3 years in Ephesus. And while in Ephesus, it seems that Tychicus was saved and started being discipled by Paul. And then when Paul left on the rest of his missionary journey, he went through a little bit of Macedonia, and then he went kind of back around Ephesus. He met with the elders there, not in the town, but a little outside of town, Miletus, and then he's headed back to Jerusalem. At that point, we know for sure Tychicus was traveling with Paul, okay? And he made that trip back to Jerusalem. And this is where, obviously, Paul was arrested, all right? But just knowing that Tychicus was around the Ephesus area, I don't know if he lived in Ephesus or he just close in that area, he was also familiar because Colossae wasn't far from Ephesus either. It's about 100 miles apart. So he would have been pretty familiar with these people, I think, that he was going to carry this letter of Colossians back to this church. So as he joined Paul on this return trip back to Jerusalem, Paul was arrested not long after he got back to Jerusalem. And he spent many months there in Jerusalem. He stood trial before Felix and Festus and Agrippa. All that last couple chapters of Acts, we read about that. Apparently, Tychicus was faithful. He stayed with Paul through all these trials. When Paul appealed his trial to Rome, to Caesar in Rome, it is believed that Tychicus traveled with Paul on the ship. Obviously, it was shipwrecked. Remember that story in the book of Acts? Finally made it to Rome. And he's been in Rome with Paul for the last at least 2 years, possibly, as Paul's been in prison in Rome. So, just that part of his biography, you can see that he's been faithful. Through many different trials that Paul went through, he didn't cut and run when things got hard. And so Paul, if you notice here, he says that Tychicus is a beloved brother, and then he says a faithful minister, fellow servant of the Lord. So Tychicus' faithfulness was proven over time as he faithfully ministered beside Paul. So to be a faithful team member in a ministry, you need to be some time to prove that, all right? And Tychicus apparently had that time. And because, letter B, faithful team members are entrusted with more responsibility. So if you're faithful, he is faithful in little, he's going to be faithful in much. Paul gave Tychicus more responsibilities. And one of these responsibilities is sending him to Colossae with this letter, all right? Tychicus was not only carrying the letter that we were reading from Colossians, but he also was carrying a letter to the Ephesian church, we know as Ephesians, all right? And he's also carrying a letter to Philemon, all right? And we have that in our Bible too, the book of Philemon. So he's carrying three letters from Paul, and this was a long journey. I'm going to throw a map up here. This is, the red line there is how Paul got to Rome, but I couldn't find another map. But Rome is clear up here, and you can see where Ephesus is right here, and Colossae would be close to Ephesus. So most of the commentaries said that he would have walked across Italy, maybe taken a boat across the Adriatic Sea, walked all the way across Macedonia, taken another ship across the Aegean Sea. So a lot of walking, a lot of boat rides. I'm not sure, maybe the other option would have just been sail from Rome and all the way around. I don't know. Maybe there's a reason that didn't happen. Maybe Paul, along the way, wanted him to stop at a couple other churches. All right, there's some churches there, Berea, Thessalonica, that he could have stopped in and encouraged those believers too along the way. I'm not sure. But anyway, Paul trusted Tychicus to travel almost 1,000 miles, a little bit more than 1,000 miles. That's a long trip. It's even a long trip for us today. I mean, if we had to go on a car ride, 1,000-mile car ride is more than just going a little ways, all right? That's a long ride. So we see that Paul entrusted him to do this. He says about Tychicus here, just another slide, just show you the relationship to how close to Ephesus, these are the towns that are mentioned. was just to give you an idea there. But Paul says about Tychicus that Tychicus is more than just his mailman, all right? He's more than just delivering this letter. He was going to tell the Colossians all about my activities. And Paul goes on to say that I have sent him to you for this very purpose, that you may know how we are and that he may encourage your hearts. So because of the value of ink and parchment, Paul didn't spend a lot of time giving personal updates about how he's doing in the letter. It's too bad he didn't, because it's kind of interesting to know how Paul was doing, maybe. But Tychicus was going to have that responsibility. He said, I'm sending you with a letter, and then when he gets there, he's going to tell you, he's going to give you the update. Everything that I didn't write down, he can tell you about how we're doing, and he's going to send me word about how you're doing. He was going to encourage the hearts of the believers there in Colossae. So I think in my mind sometimes when you think Paul sent this letter in this church and they got the letter and Tychicus maybe stood up on a Sunday and read the letter, right? And then the next Sunday they went up back to whatever they were studying in Genesis. I don't know, whatever Old Testament book, right? But it's probable that Tychicus, Paul sent him there, and he spent, if you're going to travel 1,000 miles, you're not going to stay for a weekend. You're going to stay for some time. Tychicus probably not just read the letter, but probably preached it. Probably. Kind of. We spent 3-4 months in Colossians, right, pouring over these words. It probably Tychicus would have done the same thing, explaining these things. He was there when Paul wrote it. He would have been able to answer questions, I'm sure, that would come up. And what did he mean by this, Tychicus? Oh, I remember when we were writing this. This is kind of the idea he had in mind, the context here. But he probably preached it to them. He encouraged their hearts. He was really effective at this. And he apparently was a pretty good preacher, because Paul even sent him later on, after the Colossians, he sent Tychicus to Ephesus for a short spell to spell Timothy for a while at that church in Ephesus, so that Timothy could travel back and visit Paul before he died. And he also sent Tychicus to Crete, I believe, to take over for Titus. So this guy was a kind of traveling pastor at times, very faithful and very useful to Paul, and he was trustworthy. So when we think of what it means to be a faithful team member, think of Tychicus and how he was faithful. He was faithful because he had time with Paul, he didn't cut and run, and he was also entrusted with a lot of responsibility. The next person is Onesimus. I think we're going to save Onesimus for next week. We don't have time to go through all of it. So, next week, Lord willing, we're going to wrap up looking at the rest of these men and the little conclusion that Paul had to the book of Colossians, and we will be done. And after that, I don't know where exactly we're going. Maybe to the book of
Ecclesiastes.
Okay. So, all right. Thank you very much. We'll finish up next week.